I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Bohemia in Central Europe is where gypsies came from. Bohemianism became metaphorically the posture of artistic strivers and rebels in the 19th century, immortalized by the desperate romance of Puccini's opera La Bohème. And then in 1910, a recognizably American bohemianism blossomed in New York's Greenwich Village, not just a style, but a self-conscious reformulation of intimacy, democracy, sexual equality, self-expression, and innovation across the board. It was a time and a place teeming with possibilities, as the new woman and hostess Mabel Dodge put it. Everywhere barriers went down and people reached each other who had never been in touch before, meaning anarchists, feminists, Midwestern and New England runaways, a few Ivy Leaguers and some Russian Jews, writers, peaceniks, reformers, and artists, all raising conversation to an art form in the same cafes, all connected by a new temper of mind, as the young philosopher and journalist Walter Lippmann observed. The journalist John Reed, the Hellraiser Emma Goldman, as in Warren Beatty's movie Reds, the playwright Eugene O'Neill, birth controller Margaret Sanger. The historian Christine Stansel has reconstructed this world of these American moderns in a chronicle that reads like a seriously good village party. Connection listeners, do we acknowledge a debt to the village bohemians of almost a century ago? Was there more to it than we've seen in the movies? And what of it all survives to this day? The Boho Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. Welcome, Christine Stansel, and thank you for this book. It's a wonderful read.
Christopher Lydon, it's a delight to be here.
I wish you'd walk us into Mabel Dodge's salon of a fall evening and imagine what in the world we're talking about and how we're talking about it.
That's a lovely way to begin. First of all, you need to think about Mabel Dodge herself, who was an heiress from a considerable fortune in Buffalo, New York. She had come of age in the late 1890s, the very early years of the century, and gone abroad to Florence to get her start there as a European hostess, a saloniere. There she met the Berensons, the great American art historian Bernard Berenson and his wife, Gertrude Stein and Leo Stein, and became quite an important person in the expatriate community. But she felt cramped. She said later that it was as if there was no frame for her that would fully express her inner capabilities. So she returned to New York in 1912 and, interestingly, didn't move uptown to the east side, but set herself up right north of Greenwich Village in a quite lovely apartment that she redecorated in European style. But threw her doors open weekly to an assortment of guests whose very motley qualities were what she advertised. She didn't want to be an upper-class hostess in New York. She didn't want to be taking up a part in the march of the New York elite. She wanted something quite new, which she envisioned actually as a form of artistry, because she believed that America was teeming with so many capabilities that if one could bring all of these different energies and new protagonists into the same field or frame, that one could actually fashion oneself an artist of communication. And so that's what she saw herself doing.
You use the word motley, but the word raffish keeps coming up.
Yeah.
To describe this crowd. Meaning what? What were they confronting? It was sort of, they were drawing a line against something, the patriarchy or establishment or society or convention. What was it?
They were drawing a line first and foremost against their parents and their parents' way of life, especially someone like Dodge, who didn't want to continue in the society of the Gilded Age, who didn't want to form a life out of the materials that had been handed her from these sumptuous Victorian mansions and very closed circles of fellow WASPs. So that was first and foremost where they were drawing a line. And then they were declaring that American capabilities would come from a new source, not top down from an elite, but bottom up. Raffish, because there were lots of poor people there, or let me say a sprinkling of poor people. Guess who would have been unheard of, who would have occasioned a call to the local police 10 years earlier.
Was this tokenism? Was it patronizing, or was it real? I mean,
there was certainly tokenism in Dodge's salon. For example, she liked to invite militant members of the most militant trade union of the time, the Industrial Workers of the World. But there were a number of wobblies, as they were called, who were actually self-educated workers, very decent, I don't want to say decent, presentable, cultivated men who were well-read and well-spoken. She didn't like them as much as she did the real hoi polloi, the more bedraggled, rougher-looking wobblies who looked like they'd come in straight off the coal fields or the silver mines in Colorado. So she certainly liked her plebeians rough, let me put it that way. But she made an opening, and I think what's important about Dodge isn't whether or not she was free of prejudices, because no one of her class was free of prejudice at that time, or perhaps any time, but rather what kinds of openings of imagination did she create?
You know, well, the part you're describing begins to sound like sort of radical chic of the 60s or 70s, but it also, I mean, I just wondered, people have been confronting their parents forever. What was it that defined that moment, 1910? I mean, it's Cubism in Paris, it's the time of the Armory Show in Paris and New York. What connected it, and what sort of triggered this particular consciousness, do you think?
The connections are really complicated across the Atlantic and are different for each of the arts. But what one sees thematically in the sensibilities of this generation coming of age around 1910, all the way around the Atlantic world, is the almost hysterical, one could say, or rhapsodic attention given to the word new. The belief that there was a sea change in history and that everything that had come before was benighted and passé, that everything that was happening now and was to happen represented a brand new gleaming epoch in human history. That was really a new conception of time, and one does see that all around. And, of course, then it translates into radical experiments in the arts and in writing, as well as in politics.
A lot of these names persist. I mean, in our folklore, we've spoken of John Reed, Emma Goldman, Walter Lippmann. It was just the beginning of a glorious career for him. Margaret Sanger, Max Eastman. Do you have a favorite among them?
Well, Emma Goldman can't help but be a favorite. Emma Goldman was the one character who took over the book in the sense that she demanded a chapter all on her own. Emma Goldman is so large. She's so magnificent. She is magnificent in life and in love and in thought and in politics. So certainly she's a favorite. I also liked some of the minor characters that aren't well known at all, especially some of the women whose careers started out so promisingly and then were truncated. Some of our favorite heroes weakened as I went along. John Reed probably is someone who came out weaker at the end to me than when I began.
My favorite in the book is a writer, Randolph Bourne. I want to come back to him. I'd like you to fill in a little bit of the blanks of feminism and the new notion of sexual relations in general. The feminists included a lot of men, too, who were sure that sort of the new liberated woman was going to be good for everything and everybody. But there was a great deal of experimentation in sexual relations, some married, some not, open marriages. You refer to the invention of heterosexuality at the time. Decode some of the sexual quotient here.
This was the first generation to speak openly of female desire and female sexual initiative, which is not to say that women before 1910 never experienced desire or that no one spoke of it in their private relationships. But around this moment, and Margaret Sanger is particularly important in this, people began, the feminists in particular, began to openly discuss female sexual desire as distinct and independent of men's. So there's an opening up of female sexuality, which then translated into behavior. These women also slept openly with men outside marriage. They had affairs. They slept with more than one man before marriage, and sometimes they carried on simultaneous affairs. So one of the protagonists in the book, Hutchins Hapgood, who was a very eloquent spokesman for this moment, said around 1912, the world changed. Again, echoing Virginia Woolf, and it was women who did the changing. Male sexual behavior actually, we can see continuities from the 19th century in a kind of acceptance of sleeping with people outside of marriage, and certainly an acceptance of male sexual drive. But women's open discussion, open acknowledgement, and open interest in sex was quite new.
All of the men's professions of feminism have to be sort of cross-examined here and observed over a lot of time. I mean, these marriages, as you described them, Max Eastman's, for example, don't turn out as happy events.
The marriages, no, did not. Now, I looked closely at a number of relationships because I wanted to get beyond the fulsome language of the moment. If you simply read these people, they sound, especially in their heyday of the teens, as if the brave new world of amity between men and women had actually arrived. I wanted to get underneath that and examine the particular textures of relationships. So I looked at a couple of a marriage, a love affair, a friendship, and to see what actually happened. And in the Eastman story is probably the saddest, in that Max Eastman was married to a dazzling woman, one of the real princesses of the village scene, named Ida Rao, who actually taught him the rudiments of Marxism, for which he later became known both as an exponent and a critic. A brilliant actress, a great conversant, a beautiful woman. And Eastman, in the 1940s, when he wrote his memoirs, was still they had been divorced for 25, 30 years, was still undermining Ida Rao. Such was the extent of both his connection and his animosity toward her. She herself was left holding the bag with their child, who he abandoned and went out, tried various things, went out west, but could not formulate a public career for herself after these lovely village days.
So what do we take to be the net of the real content of the sexual breakthrough here?
I was trying to make a delicate argument about both the earnestness of male feminism and its limits, to say that there was something particular and special about the ardent belief of these people that men and women could live together as equals, as real co-participants in the feminist enterprise, and to suggest that simply willing that to happen was insufficient, that these men came to the enterprise with so much baggage, with such a heritage of male privilege, believing that they were born to rule both in the household and in the culture, and that shucking those attitudes was the enterprise of a lifetime. Unfortunately, they gave it their best only for about 8-10 years, and then abandoned it in ways that the culture did as well in the 1920s.
This is the Bohemian connection with the Princeton historian Christine Stansel. Her book is called American Moderns. It's about the Greenwich Village Bohemians of 1910, 1915, the years before World War I, a spirit of voluntary poverty among a lot of them, earnestness, as she said, idealism about sex, about politics, about self-expression, and economic reform in an American mode. Part of the question here is, what of this kind of thinking, as well as style, really survives? And can we elevate talk and conversation back to the sort of art form it became in New York almost 100 years ago? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Make the American Moderns connection. Or give us your comments online at theconnection.org. One word, theconnection.org. I'd like you to digress, if you would, on Randolph Bourne. He's, to me, an enormously interesting figure, a writer, a political writer, who died young of influenza, a man with a strangely disfigured face, but a deep searcher, and a guy who, unlike Walter Lippmann at the onset of World War I, said, no, this is not our war. Sketch this marvelously attractive guy to me, Randolph Bourne.
Well, I murmured when you brought up his name because he, of all the characters in this book, was the most compelling to me. He was, as you say, a disfigured person. He was born with a severe handicap of a hunchback and a kind of distorted face from a bad forceps delivery. And in some ways, he has suffered from that handicap in our history, in that I think people have been leery of treating him as anything but pure mind. He was a brilliant writer who unfortunately left only a small body of work because he died in the great influenza epidemic of 1918. But he hasn't been treated fully as a person of great capacities for love and friendship and a real city dweller as well. He came from suburban New Jersey and I think always experienced the kind of ennui that those on the outskirts of New York who are drawn to the city but excluded from it experienced growing up. Came to Columbia, was a star student, and very much the darling of many of his professors. He wrote an essay in 1912, which was published in the Atlantic Monthly, which would be roughly comparable to publishing in the Atlantic or even the New Yorker today as a college student. So he was a golden young man of the Ivy League, bound for great things. He won a fabulous scholarship from Columbia, which sent him after graduation to Europe, where he investigated all kinds of socialist experiments and encountered various manifestations of the new in London and Germany. And returned to the States with a job waiting for him at the New Republic, which his college professors had arranged. So again, this blessed young man bound for great things, an audience ready and waiting for him. But at the New Republic, his dissent and his radicalism was a little bit too edgy, always, even before war fever began to mount. And he found himself unable to rub elbows and mingle in the very elite circles of judges and businessmen and powerful politicians that the magazine courted. When the war came, he was, like many people on the left, decidedly against the war, but he did not bend an inch, even as America. Wilson drummed up war fever, even as many people began to trim their sails to the winds. The New Republic was instrumental in carrying Wilson's desire to enter the war forth and really making a case for it before the public. So Bourne found himself frozen out by 1916, certainly. His monthly salary just kind of dissipated. And as a freelance writer in a climate which had turned against radicalism, he literally faced hunger at certain points. But it's these years that I find most moving, because you see him drawing upon circles of friendship and intimacy among peers that he had developed in the village before, and really deepening his connection to those circles so that they became a kind of fictive family that carried him through.
There's a wonderful description of him by his lady friend, Elise Gregory. It's really in which she said that his talk and his personal relationships were the core of the man. She said he had an inspired, almost Proustian gift for uncovering the motives of human conduct. Nothing was too small or too great to serve him as quarry. His mind moved in every direction, was porous to every atmosphere. It's also
I love that quote.
Yes, it's also the early death, but the standing up against not just the war fever, but his friends and powerful peers like Lippmann, who were going the other way, that make him so touching. But, you know, would you just talk a little bit about his relationship with Elise Gregory, too? There was another experimental love relationship in a way, but never satisfying, I suspect.
Yes, I wanted Bourne and Elise Gregory in the book because they're a counterpart to the Eastman Ra doleful saga. They were friends, the best of friends. When he came back to New York after his year abroad in Europe, he met her through friends downtown in Greenwich Village, and immediately they felt the kind of affinity I sometimes see among my Princeton students. There was never any sexual pull between them, but they were, this man and woman, the best of friends. They ate dinner together every night. They complained to each other about their personal setbacks. They cavilled about their triumphs. They shared their disappointments in love. She lent him her apartment when she went out of town. She was a suffragist and so would sometimes campaign on the suffrage trail for weeks at a time, and she would let him stay there. So she helped bail him out in his years of financial difficulty. But I think in that relationship, you see a flowering of modernist emotional possibilities in this kind of intense intimacy between a man and a woman that, if anything, gains from their acknowledgement of their gender differences.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Bohemian connection, the American Moderns connection, with the historian Christine Stansel. 1-800-423-TALK, or you can give us your comments online at theconnection1word.org. Terry is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Hello, Chris.
Welcome, Terry.
I'm just so happy to welcome you back.
Oh, thank you.
Connection. I've been waiting for you for 3 weeks.
Oh, thank you.
And when I woke up Tuesday, I thought, oh, great, Chris is back. So you're irreplaceable, but anyway. I was wondering if your guest was going to bring up Dorothy Day's name. I have this feeling we were going to get through the hour without her name being mentioned. And I was explaining to the screener that... you know, I'm sure you know who she is.
Of course. Founder of the Catholic Worker, and she's in the book, very much so.
Okay, good. I noticed that, you know, she was friends with Eugene O'Neill and hung out with that whole crowd, and then met Peter Morin, who was a deeply religious character, and through him, she was kind of converted, she was converted to Catholicism, basically. She went from this real strong socialist position that she held for years to radical religious, you know, and of course this isn't the week to bring this up with your shows on robots and atheists and bohemians, but anyway, I noticed that she was kind of shut out in a lot of ways by that crowd when they saw that she was being driven by her religion. But she went on to do such great work, and the Catholic worker movement is alive and well, and you can still buy the paper for a penny.
Amen. Christine Stansel, give us your take on Dorothy Day.
I'm so glad you brought her up. In fact, I was scouring the village right a couple of weeks ago for the remnants of the old village, and just about the only remnant that I could see in the midst of all the gleaming new restaurants that have taken over the tenements was the headquarters of the Catholic Workers' Party, which is still there, still
soup
tending
kitchen.
Still tending to homeless men, still putting out the newspaper. Day is a very interesting character, and I am in the book. I'm interested in her. The book only goes up to 1919, and Day's radical Catholicism flowered after that. In the period with which I'm concerned, she was really in the thick of things in the village, living a very wild youth. I don't know if you know, but Eugene O'Neill was not just a friend; he was her lover. And Day.
And she was a single mother by another parent, and yet she's also spoken of not just with respect and sort of political devotion, she's spoken of as a candidate for American sainthood. We'll come back to Dorothy Day and the American Bohemians in Christine Stansel's reconstruction of Greenwich Village in the teens. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We'll be back after a short break. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Bohemian Connection. Bohemian today is one half of the David Brooks line about Bobos, Bohemian Bourgeois, the marriage in the sort of Starbucks mode of two very different styles. Our guest, Christine Stansel, has written a history of the Greenwich Village Bohemians in the neighborhood of 1910, who were, at least by American standards, the real thing. Part of the question, Christine Stansel, and Connection listeners, is what is the real permanent thread in our own culture of the bohemianism of the village in the early days before World War I? 1-800-423-8255 makes the American Moderns connection. Do you know any real bohemians to this day, Connection listeners? Give us a call or make a comment online at The Connection, one word, .org. Christine Stansel, go back just one step. Where did all these bohemians come from to the village in 1910? Who were they before they got there?
They were people from many parts of America, from the provinces and from big cities that were coming to see themselves for the first time as secondary to New York, especially in the minds of the young. They were Eastern European Jews who knew about Bohemia from the French example and had passed through various Bohemias of European capitals on the way to the United States. And they were graduates of the Ivy League, like Bourne, like John Reed, the Vassar girls who also came to the village, who had known about Bohemia from popular literature and popular theater, like Puccini. I think that, let me just say this, I think that in the American context, one thing that's important to remember is that these were children of the generation that had fought the Civil War. They were looking for a great project that was commensurable with that of their parents. Abolition was dead. The race question was not on the minds of white people, except for a very, very few. They saw the class question and the woman question as the social issues which they could seas and make both America a different place and humanity a better place. And Bohemia provided a certain stage for that.
Then and now, it's only fair to say they were the easy targets for mockery. I mean, we make fun of the sort of boho pretensions of people in our own world, but at the time, H.L. Mencken, the old grouch, thought of these people as sort of fixated sophomores, and somebody in your book wrote a funny ditty as follows: way down south in Greenwich Village, where the spinsters come for thrillage, where they speak of soul relations with the sordid Slavic nations, neath the guise of feminism, dodging social ostracism, they get away with much in Washington Square. Should we take the mockery seriously? What does it tell us?
Bohemia doesn't guarantee idealism. It can be a receptacle for idealism, especially in the incipient stages of any Bohemia. But it always has had a close relationship to commerce, to selling things in the cultural marketplace. Mm. One reason that people become Bohemians is that they are often outsiders of various stripes who have no ability to sell their stories to the magazines or to sell their paintings to the galleries. And Bohemia gives them a way to transform themselves from lowly newcomers to the city to passionate artists. So the mockery is always about the way in which Bohemia becomes disseminated as a both a personal style and a consumer style. I think at the point we are in American history, any change in the culture is bound to be registered as a consumer style sooner or later. Hmm. But that's not to say that Bohemia didn't represent a real alternative and important new ways of thought that contained within them the seeds of integrity at the time.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Bohemian connection. Ken is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can.
Oh, good. I just wanted to make a comment. My godfather was a man named Ira Glackin, who was the son of William Glackens, the painter, part of the Ashcan School. And growing up with him was one of the great delights. My sister-in-law, who's British, said that he was the only American she ever met that was a real conversationalist. And he was that and more. One of the great things that came down through him growing up with his father and mother in New York in the 10s and 20s was real sense of irony towards religion. And given he was my godfather, he always used to make light of that he wasn't following my upbringing close enough, making sure that I was religiously provided for. So when I turned 21, he gave me a book that was titled What God Has Revealed to Man. And upon opening it, you only found empty page after empty page. And I just wanted to make that comment that was something that came through very strong through him, through that Bohemian lifestyle, was a certain comic relief and irony towards the bound and staid religious offerings that one had.
God was dead in these circles, I take it, Christine Stenzel.
These were not religious people. Neither the Gentiles nor the Jews. Dorothy Day, of course, went back to religion. If religion or God enters their discourse, it's kind of God that's very mystical. Mabel Dodge experimented with peyote at one time and thought she saw God. But God is not featured in these discussions.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Bohemian connection. George is on the line.
Hello. Good to have you back, Chris.
Thank you, George.
And the connection is one place where a conversation blooms in the 21st century.
Bohemia forever on the airwaves. Go for it.
My grandfather was a Jewish socialist, and in our family history, the municipal election of 1917, in which the socialists made a strong showing, and according to family lore, had the election stolen from them by Tammany Hall, Meyer London, and other people. You must remember Fiorello LaGuardia was a socialist before he was a Republican. And in point of fact, my grandfather was elected housing court judge in that 1917 election, claiming to be the first socially, the first democratically elected socialist judge in the world. And I'm interested in whether the book talks about that election, which seems to be maybe the high point of Jewish socialism in New York history.
Christine Steffel.
Yes, that election is really interesting because it occurs, and the socialists did very well in the New York State Legislature that year as well. That election occurred right in the middle of the anti-war crackdown, so that there was this tremendous tension in the city between the sizable socialist vote and enthusiasm on the left, which was anti-war, and the intensifying war fever. One of the things I do talk about in the book is the actual history of repression during the war in the city itself, which was quite intense and which has never been discussed. But not only socialists, but feminists, anyone who was connected with these free speech circles, and certainly the trade unionists, were subject to real reprisals.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned free speech. It is kind of a code for a lot of things happening in this period. What did it mean to these folk?
There's a history to free speech. We think of it as a given of our constitutional culture, but in fact, the term and the legal practices associated with it were really really emerged in the 1890s around Salvation Army speakers who wanted to use public places to make their pitch, and then slightly later, Socialist Party speakers, and then most intensely and importantly, the IWW, who carried on a series of free speech fights in the West, organizing and proselytizing after 1905. To the villagers, free speech, they took that militant practice and transformed it into a kind of sophisticated, modernist, avant-garde style, which replicated a kind of juxtaposition of the collage, I say, took random topics and put them together and invited all comers to participate. So there are different levels of it. There's a cultural consumer's level, and then there's the militant politico level. Mm. But certainly by 1917, free speech of all kinds was under assault from the government.
And the Comstock Clause, I mean, we've forgotten all the things that were literally taboo.
Yes. The Comstock Laws were what turned the urban sophisticates into a real political force, because they drew a parallel between the repression of trade union speech in the provinces and the repression of nude drawings and sexually revelatory writing in the cultural capitals. So they saw themselves as the beleaguered Wobblies were in the silver towns of Colorado, so the beleaguered artists were in New York City, where the Comstock forces of Comstockery could seize their books and their drawings and close down galleries.
1-800-423-8255, the Greenwich Village Bohemian Connection, around 1910. Catherine is on the line.
Hi. I was wondering if the author could talk about Mabel Dodge's move to New Mexico and her relationship to the local population there, and if any of this. I'm from New Mexico, and her bohemian experience there didn't relate to, it seems to me, much social welfare issues with the local community.
I don't know a lot about Mabel Dodge in Taos. I do know that her relationship to the Pueblos was not spurious. She was deeply in love with Anthony Lewin, who was I think that was his name, a principal of the Taos Pueblo, and made a very passionate, created a very passionate and devoted marriage to him. And I believe took up Native American causes quite ardently. It was certainly a different kind of bohemia, and whether or not you could even call it a bohemia or whether we should return to the idea of salon, which was hers in Florence, I'm not so sure. She did invite artists and writers out there to gallivant around and enjoy the energies of the Indian people. But I think there was the same, you could certainly say that there was the same interest in energizing American culture from places other than Europe, from places that were right there under your nose, but had been seen as lowly and vulgar before.
Thank you, Catherine. 1-800-423-8255, the Bohemian Connection. Chuck is on the line.
Hi, Professor. I'd like you to know that I might be one of the few of the listeners that actually has the collected works of Randolph Bourne right by his bed.
Ah, lovely.
And I discovered him in 1970.
Where'd you find the books, Chuck?
Well, the book was from an old course I had in 1970 at Clark University, and Radical Reform America, when people at that time were trying to reinvent the world also and create close personal relationships. And one of the things, I don't know if you mentioned that Byrne, before he went to Columbia, actually had to work 4 years. I think he worked as a piano roll person.
Yes.
And that was very sort of bitter. He was older when he went to Columbia, and it was very, very hard work. And he always had the sense of what type of this repetitive type of really grinding work had, which a lot of, I think, maybe the other writers had no really first-hand experience of.
And yes.
What did you learn from the work of Randolph Bourne for our time, Chuck?
Well, I think that if you read his essays on friendship, his essays on being a disabled person, the essay on war, the essay on how all these people, in terms of the World War One, were turning for the war, sort of like mass hysteria. Even someone like Sigmund Freud at the time said, "My whole id is in the service of Austria-Hungary," and how difficult it is to stand, for a lot of reasons, not only philosophically but also, as the professor mentioned, financially, against this type of juggernaut. Very, very difficult, and takes a very tough person to do that. And I think that when I was in Europe, even though they're very different types of writers, we used to compare him to an Italian writer called Antonio Gramsci. They're very different types of writers, but Gramsci was also someone who was deformed, a dwarf, and wrote against Mussolini and spent many years in jail in Italy. And, even in our minds, instinctively, we sort of, were able to, link these two men who were somewhat contemporaries. The question I had is it true that Byrne was, at the time of his death, was he engaged to Esther Cornell, the actress?
The evidence is a little shaky. He certainly had some kind of love affair with her. And it seems, she seems to have been cooling on him, but it's not quite clear. When he died, however, I did want to say this when Chris and I were talking about him earlier. When he died, he was surrounded by a group of friends who nursed him and tended him for days and days right up through his death. And I think she was one of those friends.
I just wanted to, I want to read some more of Randolph Bourne. And I wonder, Chuck, is he in print? Can you find the man's work?
I'm not even sure. I looked in the web sometimes for Randolph Bourne. There's very few citations. I'm not sure if the collected, the collected volumes are in print now or not. This is an old book that I bought many years ago. I'm not really sure.
I'm glad you found him, and I'm looking. Christine Stansel, I just wanted to say, one of the sort of subtext or the stars of this whole story really is the city of New York, and you make the point that the cultural capital as of 100 years ago might have turned out to be Chicago or San Francisco or even Boston for that matter, but it was bohemianism in Greenwich Village in a way that gave New York its kind of cultural position. Part of what's being made in all this period is our idea of New York City itself, I take it.
Yes, the idea of the lyrical idea of New York as a place where you can go and unleash hidden capacities within yourself, whether they are the hidden capacities of artistry or love or sexuality, that they can blossom there in a way that they couldn't anyplace else in the country. Mm. New York had always been a big city. It had always been an economically powerful city, but it had never been seen as a beautiful city or a particularly alluring city until this moment when one sees a striking change in the language when the group of European expatriates and artists arrived in the harbor in 1915. They talk about a city, a glittering city that looks as if it's set in jewels. This is all a new kind of trope of the city as almost the land of Oz, is something stunning, whose very streets can transform you as a person.
Hmm. Well, it's a kind of a prefiguring of the Leonard Bernstein or the musical city or the Bronx is up, the
yes.
Battery is down kind of celebration
yes.
of
yes.
the place in the whole world to be if you're really alive, if you're modern. The other question here that we haven't dealt with is, besides World War I, what killed this moment?
Well, World War I and the repression that ensued had a decimating impact on this quite diffuse and flexible milieu of radicalism and art. The Russian Revolution was the other factor because as people staggered home from Europe and as those who had remained behind staggered back to their lives after the jailings and the trials and the fear of jailings and trials, the Russian Revolution and the consequent polarization of the left really meant that for the first time, party affiliations took over this world. There had been a socialist party before, but it was big. It was imbricated in American politics and American democracy in very powerful ways. Suddenly in the 20s, there was a different geography of allegiances, and one of those allegiances was to Soviet Russia, and a whole recharting of the cartography of art and the avant-garde occurred because of that in the 20s. Mm. So the tone shifts. It's much tougher, more rigorous, more ideological. Feminism also died for all practical purposes after its great triumph in 1920 with the winning of women's suffrage.
The other thing that's interesting to me, if I may just leap in here, is that the great artistic world figures that emerged from this culture and this country in the 20s were not these folks. And these folks were marginalized in a way by the likes of Ernest Hemingway or Faulkner or Duke Ellington or Fitzgerald. I mean, the great eternal voices of the century were not these bohemians in the end, were they?
That's exactly right. Their achievement was not an artistic achievement. Their achievement was creating a different kind of space for artistic achievement, I think, that then other people could enter, and in making political combinations that had never been made before and that I think endured, even if sometimes sublimated or often sublimated in American history. But they were not a generation that produced great paintings or great some poems, perhaps, William Carlos Williams.
Eugene O'Neill, certainly.
O'Neill, Marianne Moore came in at the very end, but not the great novels or the great paintings.
Christine Sansel, thank you enormously for this elegant and enormously interesting book, American Moderns, Bohemian New York and the Creation of a New Century. Christine Sansel is a professor of history at Princeton. Thank you. We had help today from Nahani Rouse, Glenn Alexander, John Hoder, Will Smith, Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bachari. The Connection is produced by bohemians like Catherine Bidwell, Dan Furst, Hitesh Hatti, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior Bohemian. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, a 20-year-old man in New Hampshire hopes to set the Guinness Book of World Records by having 101 body piercings done in one session. We'll have a report.